silent, trembling, while Helica strutted in front of the great armored tank. Behind the curved plaz walls, the mist-shrouded form of Edric was so peculiar that Uxtal could not tell if the filtered voice carried an implied threat. The navigator spoke directly to him rather than to the Matre Superior, which was sure to set her off. The old Tliloxu masters knew how to create melange with axolotl tanks. You will rediscover this process for us. The navigator's distorted, inhuman face floated behind the glass. Uxtal groaned inside. He had already proved himself incapable of that. I have given him that command, Helica said with a sniff. For many years he has failed me. Then he must cease failing. Uxtal wrung his hands. It is not a trivial task. Worlds full of Tliloxu masters worked all throughout the famine times to perfect the complex process. I am only one man, and the old masters did not share their secrets with the lost Tliloxu. He gulped again. Surely the guild knew all this already. If your people are so ignorant, how did they create face dancers so superior to any previous ones? The navigator asked. Uxtal shuddered, knowing now that his people had not, after all, created Crone or his superior breed of shapeshifters. Apparently, they had merely been found out in the scattering. I am not interested in face dancers, Helica snapped. She had always seemed at odds with Crone. I am interested in prophets from Melange. Uxtal swallowed. When the masters all died, their knowledge died with the last one. I have been working diligently to reacquire the technique. He did not remind them that the honored Matres themselves were responsible for losing those secrets. Helica did not take even implied criticism well. Then use the indirect approach. Edric delivered his words like a blow. Bring one of them back. The idea took Uxtal by surprise. He certainly had the ability to use an axolotl tank to resurrect one of the masters, provided he had viable cells. But they are all dead. Even in Bandalong, the masters were killed many years ago. He remembered the boy Baron and Helica gleefully feeding body parts to the sligs. Where am I to get cells for such a gola? The Matre Superior stopped her tiger-like pacing and spun toward him as if to deliver a fatal thrust. That is all you needed. A few cells? 13 years and you did not tell me you required only a few cells to solve this problem? The orange in her eyes glowed like embers. He quailed. The idea had never occurred to him. I did not think it a possibility. The masters are gone. She growled at him. How stupid do you think we are, little man? We would not dispose of anything so valuable. If the navigator's scheme will work, if we can create melange and sell it to the guild, then I will give you the cells you need. Edric's enormous head bobbed behind the plaz walls, and his bulging eyes glared at the quivering researcher. You accept this project? We accept it. This lost Tliloxu man works for us and survives only at our pleasure. Uxtal was still reeling from the revelation.
Then
Then some of the old masters are still alive? Her quirk of a smile was frightening. Alive? After a fashion. Alive enough to provide the cells you need. She gave the navigator a perfunctory bow and grabbed Uxtal by the arm. I will take you to them. You must start right away. As the Matre Superior led him into a lower level of the commandeered Bandalong Palace, the stench grew worse with every step. He stumbled, but she dragged him along like a rag doll. Though honored Matres decorated themselves with colorful fabrics and gaudy adornments, they were not particularly clean or fastidious. Helica wasn't bothered by the stink wafting out of the dim chambers ahead. To her, it was the smell of suffering. They still live, but you won't get anything from their minds, little man. Helica gestured for Uxtal to precede her. That isn't what we kept them for. With uncertain steps, he entered the shadowy room. He heard bubbling noises, the rhythmic hiss of respirators, gurgling pumps. It reminded him of the noisome lair of some foul beast. Ruddy light seeped from glow panels near the floor and ceiling. He drew shallow breaths to keep himself from gagging as his eyes adjusted. Inside, he saw 24 small men, or what remained of them. He counted quickly before absorbing other details, searching for numerical significance. 24. 3 groups of 8. The gray-skinned men had the distinctive features of old masters, higher caste leaders of the Tliloxu. Over many centuries, genetic drift and inbreeding had given the lost Tliloxu a somewhat distinctive appearance. To outsiders, the gnomish men all looked alike, but Uxtal easily noted the differences. All of them lay strapped to flat, hard tables as if they'd been mounted on racks. Though the victims were naked, so many tubes and sensors were connected to them that he could see little of their gaunt forms. The Tliloxu masters had a nasty habit of constantly growing golas of themselves as replacements. Like regurgitating food again and again. Helica walked up to one of the tables, looked down at the slack-faced man there. These were golas of one of the last Tliloxu masters, spare bodies to be exchanged when he grew too old. She pointed. This one was called Waf, and he'd had dealings with the honored Matres. He was killed on Rakis, I believe, and never had the chance to reawaken his gola. Uxtal was reluctant to approach. Stunned, he looked at all the silent, identical men in the room. Where did they come from? We found them stored and preserved after we had eliminated all the other masters. She smiled. So, we chemically destroyed their brains and put them to a better use here. The 24 sets of machinery hummed and hissed. Snake-like tentacles and tubes mounted to the groins of the mindless golas began to pump. The strapped-down bodies twitched as the machinery made loud sucking sounds. Now the only thing they're good for is to provide sperm, should we ever decide to use it. Not that we particularly value your race's disappointing genetic material, but decent males seem to be in short supply here on Tlilox. Scowling, she turned away as Uxtal looked on in horror. She seemed to be hiding something. He sensed she hadn't told him all of her reasons. They are like your axolotl tanks, in a way. A good use for the males of your race. Isn't it what you Tliloxu have done to females for so many millennia? These men deserved nothing better. She looked down her nose. I'm sure you agree. Uxtal struggled to cover his revulsion. How they must despise us. To do such a thing to males, even to a Tliloxu master, their enemy, was monstrous. The words of the great belief made clear that God had created females for the sole purpose of reproduction. A female could serve God in no greater way than to become an axolotl tank. Her brain was merely extraneous tissue. But to think of males in similar terms was inconceivable. If he hadn't been so terrified of her, he might have told Helica a thing or two. This sacrilege would surely bring down the wrath of God. Uxtal had loathed these honored matres before. Now he could barely keep himself from fainting. The machines continued to milk the mindless males on the tables. Hurry up and take your cell scrapings, Helica snapped. I don't have all day, and neither do you. Guild navigators aren't as pleasant to work with as I am. Axolotl tanks have brought forth Golas and Melange, as well as face dancers and twisted mentats. Out in the scattering, lost Tliloxu genetic work was most likely responsible for creating futars amphibians. What other axolotl-grown creatures did they concoct in those fecund wombs? What else remains out there that is still unknown to us? Bene Gesserit Symposium, opening remarks by Mother Commander Mirbella. In the 2 years since Gamu, one honored Matre stronghold had fallen after another, a total of 12 smaller rebel enclaves eradicated in maneuvers that would have made even the best swordmaster of Ganaz proud. Mirbella's Valkyries had proven themselves time and again. Soon, the last festering wound would be cauterized. Then humanity would be ready to face the far worse challenge. Recently, Chapter House had made another substantial spice payment to the weapon shops of Richesi. For years, the Richesian industries had been dedicated to building armaments for the new sisterhood, retooling their manufacturing centers, and ramping up to full-scale production. Although they regularly delivered warships and weaponry, their factories were still gearing up for the majority of items the sisters had ordered. Within a few years, the Mother Commander would have an overwhelming armada of ships to stand together and defend against the outside enemy. She hoped it would be soon enough. Inside her private chambers, working through reams of administrative matters, Mirbella was relieved to be interrupted by a report from Gamu. Since the original crackdown there, Jeunesse, promoted to regimental commandant, had been in charge of the consolidation, strengthening the sisterhood's hold on the industries and population. But her daughter was not among the three Valkyries who strode into her office. All three, she noted, had originally been honored matres. One was Kyria, the hard-edged scout who had investigated the distant enemy-devastated planet, home of the damaged honored matre battleship that had come to Chapter House years ago. Given the opportunity, Kyria had been eager to help quash the insurgents on Gamu. Mirbella sat up straight. Your report? Have you rooted out, killed, or converted the remaining rebel whores? The former honored matres flinched at the term, especially when used by someone who had previously been one of their own. Kyria stepped forward to speak. The regimental commandant is not far behind us, Mother Commander, but she wanted us to report to you immediately. We have made an alarming discovery. The other two women nodded, as if conceding Korea's authority. Mirbella noted one of them had a dark bruise on her neck. Kyria turned toward the hall and barked orders to a pair of male workers standing outside. They entered carrying a heavy, lifeless form wrapped crudely in preserving sheets. Kyria tore the covering away from the head. The face was turned away, but the body had the shape and clothing of a man. Intrigued, Mirbella stood up. What is this? Is he dead? Quite dead, but it is not a man, nor a woman. The Mother Commander came around from behind her cluttered desk. What do you mean? Is it not human? It is whatever it chose to be, man or woman, boy or girl, hideous or pleasing in appearance. She turned the thing's head toward Mirbella. The facial features were bland and humanoid, with staring black button eyes, a pug nose, and pallid waxy skin. Mirbella narrowed her eyes. I have never seen a face dancer so close, nor one so dead. I presume this is their natural state. Who can tell, Mother Commander? When we rooted out and killed many of the rebel whores, alarmed, we brought in truthsayers to interrogate the surviving honored Matres, but found no more face dancers that way. Kyria pointed at the body. This was one of the survivors. When she tried to escape, we killed her. And that is when her true identity came out. Undetectable by truthsayers? Are you certain? Absolutely. Mirbella wrestled with the complex implications. Astounding. Face dancers were creatures made by the Tliloxu, and the new ones who had returned with the lost Tliloxu were far superior to any the Bene Gesserit had previously encountered. Apparently, the new ones worked with, or for, the honored Matres. And now she knew they could fool truthsayers. The questions fell faster than the answers. Why then had the honored Matres destroyed the Tliloxu worlds, attempting to exterminate all of the original masters? Mirbella had been an honored Matre herself, and she still did not understand. Intrigued, she touched the skin of the corpse, the coarse white hair on the head. Each strand was rough against her fingertips. She inhaled deeply, sifting and sorting with her olfactory senses, but could find no distinctive smell. Bene Gesserit archives claimed that a face dancer could be detected by a very subtle odor, but she wasn't sure. After a long silence, Kyria said, "We conclude that more of the rebel honored Matres may indeed be face dancers, but we found no telltale indicators, no way to detect them whatsoever." Except for killing them, one of the other two sisters said. That was the only way to be sure. Mirbella frowned. Effective, perhaps, but not entirely useful. We can't just execute everyone. Kyria matched her frown. That leads to a different kind of crisis, Mother Commander. Though we killed hundreds of face dancers among the rebels on Gamu, we were unable to capture a single one of them alive. Not that we know of. They are perfect mimics. Absolutely perfect. Deeply troubled, Mirbella paced in her office. You killed hundreds of face dancers. Does that mean you slaughtered thousands of rebels? What percentage of them are these infiltrators? Kyria shrugged. Posing as honored Matres, they formed an attack squadron and tried to retake Gamu by force. They had a very complex and detailed plan, striking at vulnerabilities, and they rallied a great many of the rebel women to their cause. Fortunately, we found the Viper's nest and struck. The Valkyries would have killed them either way, whether they were face dancers or whores. One of the other women added, "Ironically, the honored Matres who followed them were just as surprised as we were when their leaders turned into this." She gestured toward the inhuman cadaver. Even they did not know they had been infiltrated. The third sister said, Regimental Commandant Idaho has placed the whole planet under quarantine, subject to your further orders. Mirbella kept herself from voicing the obvious security nightmare. If that many face dancers have infiltrated the rebel whores on Gamu, do we have any among us here on Chapter House? They had brought so many candidates for retraining. Her policy had been to absorb as many former honored matres as were willing to undergo the sisterhood's instruction, their loyalty monitored by strict truthsayers. After her capture on Gamu, their leader Niella had killed herself rather than be converted. But what about the ones who claimed to cooperate? Uneasily, Mirbella studied the three women, trying to detect whether they were shapeshifters too. But if that were true, why would they raise the suspicion in the first place? Sensing the Mother Commander's suspicions, Kyria looked at her companions. These are not face dancers. Nor am I. Isn't that exactly what a face dancer would say? I do not find your assurances terribly convincing. We would submit to truthsayer interrogation, one of the other two said, but you already know that is no longer reliable. Kyria pointed out, In pitched battle, we noticed a strange thing. While some of the face dancers died quickly from their wounds, others did not. In fact, when two were on the verge of death, their features began to change prematurely. So, if we brought a subject to the verge of death, a face dancer would reveal itself. Mirbella sounded skeptical. Precisely. With a sudden movement, Mirbella flung herself at Kyria and hit her with a hard kick to the temple. The Mother Commander placed the blow precisely, shifting her foot a fraction of a centimeter from what would have been fatal. Kyria fell to the floor like a stone. Her companions did not move. On her back, Kyria gasped for breath, her eyes glazed. In a blur of motion, before they could run, Mirbella felled the other two in the same manner, rendering them all helpless. She loomed over the trio, ready to deliver the killing blows. But except for contortions of pain, their features did not change. In contrast, the ghoulish face of the dead shapeshifter was unmistakable in its preservation wrappings. The Mother Commander tended to Kyria first, using Bene Gesserit healing holds to calm the victim's breathing. Then she massaged the woman's injured temple, her fingers finding the exact pressure points. The former honored matre responded quickly and finally managed to sit up on her own. Because the three women had not transformed meant either that they were not face dancers or that the test did not work. Her uneasiness grew as questions continued to rear up. She found herself in uncharted territory. Face dancers could be anywhere. Simply because something is not seen does not mean it is not there. Even the most observant can make this mistake. One must always be alert. Bashar Miles Tegg, Strategy Discussions. Miles Tegg arrived on the navigation bridge with a specific purpose in mind. He took a chair at the console beside Duncan, who only reluctantly turned his attention from the controls. Since his own distraction and preoccupation with Mirbella had nearly allowed them to be trapped by the sparkling net, Duncan had been conscientious in his duties to the point of isolating himself. He refused to let down his guard again. Tegg said, When I died the first time, Duncan, I was nearly 300 standard years old. There were ways I could have slowed my aging, through massive consumption of melange, certain souk treatments, or Bene Gesserit biological secrets. But I chose not to. Now I am feeling old again. He looked over at the dark-haired man. In all your Gola lifetimes, Duncan, have you ever been truly old?
I'm more ancient than you can possibly imagine. I remember every one of my lives and countless deaths. So much violence against me.
He allowed himself a wistful smile.
But there were a few times when I had a long and happy life, with a wife and children, and I died peacefully in my sleep. Those were the exceptions, however, not the rule.
Teg looked at his own hands. This body was no more than a child's when we left. 16 years. Children have been born, and people have died, but everything aboard the Ithaca seems stagnant. Is there more to our destiny than constant flight? Will it ever stop? Will we ever find a new planet?
Duncan took another scan of space all around the drifting ship. Where is it safe, Miles?
The hunters will never give up, and each trip through fold space is dangerous.
Should I try to find the Oracle of Time and ask for her help?
Can we trust the Guild?
Should I take us into that other strange, empty universe again?
We have more options than we admit, but nothing that makes a good plan.
We should look for some place unknown and unpredictable. We can travel routes that no mind can follow. You and I could do it.
Duncan stood from the pilot's chair and gestured to the controls.
Your prescience is as good as mine, Miles.
Probably better with your Atreides bloodline.
You've never given me reason to doubt your competence.
Go ahead and guide us there.
His offer was sincere.
Teg's expression became uncertain, but he accepted the console. He could feel Duncan's confidence and acceptance, and it reminded him of his past military campaigns. As the old Bashar, he had led swarms of men to their deaths. They had accepted his tactics. More often than not, he had found a way to make violence unnecessary, and his men had come to think of his abilities as nearly supernatural. Even when he failed, his men died knowing that if even the great Bashar could not succeed, then the problem itself must be utterly unsolvable.
Teg studied the projections around him, trying to get a feel for the space in which they roamed. In planning for this, before coming to the navigation bridge, he had consumed 4 days' ration of spice. Again, he had to do the impossible. As the spice worked through him, he called up coordinates, letting the doubling vision of his innate prescience guide him. He would take the vessel where it needed to be. Without second-guessing himself or performing a backup navigational calculation, he lurched the Ithaca into the void. The Holtzman engines folded space, plucked them from one part of the galaxy, and deposited them somewhere else. Teg delivered the no-ship to an unremarkable solar system with a yellow sun, 2 gas giant planets, and 3 smaller rocky worlds closer to the star, but nothing within the habitable life zone. The readings were completely blank. And yet, his prescience had taken him to this place. For a reason. For the better part of an hour, he continued to study the empty orbits, probing with his intense senses, sure that his ability had not led them astray. After the activation of the Holtzman engines, Shiana had come to the navigation bridge, afraid that the net had located them again. Now she waited anxiously to see what he had found. She did not discount the Bashar's certainty. There's nothing here, Miles.
Duncan leaned over his shoulder to study the same screens. Teg couldn't disprove the statement, but he did not agree with it.
No. Wait a moment.
His gaze blurred,
and suddenly he spotted it. Not with his real vision, but with a dark and isolated corner of his mind. The potential had been stored deep in his complex genetics, awakened through the devastating T-probe torture that had also unlocked his ability to move at incredible speed. The instinctive capacity to see no ships was another talent Teg had carefully guarded from the Bene Gesserits, afraid of what they might do to him. The no field he beheld now, however, was larger than the most mammoth ship he had ever seen. Much larger. Something's there. As he guided the no ship closer, he sensed no danger, only a deep mystery. The orbital zone wasn't as empty as he had at first thought. The silent blot was merely an illusion, a blurry shroud large enough to cover a whole planet. A whole planet. I see nothing. Shiana looked at Duncan, who shook his head. No, trust me. Fortunately, the guise of the no field was not perfect, and as Teg struggled to think of a likely-sounding explanation, the field flickered, and a speckle of sky appeared for an instant before it was quickly covered again. Duncan saw it too. He's right. He gave Teg an awed and questioning glance. How did you know? The Bashar has Atreides' genes, Duncan. You should know by now not to underestimate them, Shiana said. As their ship approached, the planetary no-field flickered one more time to give a tantalizing glimpse of an entirely hidden world, a splash of sky, green-brown continents. Teg did not take his eyes from the screen. A network of satellites generating no-fields would explain it. But the field is either flawed or degenerating. The no-ship approached the world that wasn't there. Duncan sank back in the command chair. It is almost inconceivable. The energy requirements would be immense. Those people must have had access to technologies beyond our own. For years, Chapter House itself had been camouflaged by a moat of no-ships, enough to mask the planet from a cursory distant search. But that shield had been sketchy and imperfect, forcing Duncan to remain aboard the landed no-ship. This world, though, was completely surrounded by an all-encompassing no-field. As Teg guided the vessel forward, they traversed the unmarked ring of satellites that generated the overlapping no-field. The orbital sensors were blinded for an instant, but the Ithaca's similar masking technology allowed it to pass through. Behind them, as if their passage had disrupted a delicate balance, the planetary no-field flickered again, winked in and out of existence, and then restored itself. Such an expenditure of energy would have bankrupted entire empires, Shiana said. No one would do it on a whim. Somebody certainly wanted to stay hidden down there. We must be cautious. We can learn much from those who came before us. The most valuable legacy our predecessors can leave us is the knowledge of how to avoid the same deadly mistakes. Reverend Mother Shiana, Ithaca Logs. The powerful civilization that had once thrived on the No Planet was dead now. Everything was dead. As the Ithaca circled the hidden planet in a tight orbit, the bristling quills of scanners picked out silent cities, the distinctive remnants of industry, abandoned agricultural settlements, empty living complexes. Every outside transmission band was utterly still, without so much as the faint static of repeating weather satellites or distress beacons. The inhabitants went to great lengths to hide, Teg said. But it looks as if they were found after all. Shiana studied the readings. In light of the mystery, she had summoned several other sisters to help her study the data and develop conclusions. The ecosystem seems to be undamaged. The minimal levels of pollutants and residue in the air suggest that this place has been uninhabited for a century or more, depending on its prior level of industrialization. The prairies and forests are untouched. Everything looks perfectly normal, almost pristine. Garimi's frown etched deep creases around her lips and on her forehead. In other words, this was not caused in the same manner as the horrors turned Rakkus into a charred ball. No, only the people are gone. Duncan shook his head, studying the information as it flowed across the screens, including city layouts and atmospheric details. Either they left, or they perished. Do you think they were hiding from the outside enemy? So desperate to remain unseen that they covered their entire world in a no-field? It is an honored Matre world? Garimi asked. Shiana reached a decision. This place could hold a key to what we are running from. We have to learn what we can. If honored Matres lived down there, what drove them away, or what killed them? Garimi held up one finger. The whores came to the Bene Gesserit demanding to know how we control our bodies. They were frantic to understand how Reverend Mothers can manipulate our immune functions cell by cell. Of course. Speak clearly, Garimi. What do you mean? Teg's voice was abrupt, the hardened battle commander. She turned a sour look on him. You are a Mentat. Make a prime projection. Teg did not bristle at the scolding. Instead, his eyes became glazed for just a moment, and then his expression returned. Ah. If the whores wanted to learn how to control immune responses, then perhaps the enemy attacked them using a biological agent. The whores did not have the skills or the medical science to make themselves impervious. Therefore, they wanted to learn the secrets of Bene Gesserit immunity, even if they had to obliterate planets to do so. They were desperate. They were terrified of the enemy's plagues, Shiana said. Duncan leaned forward to stare at the peaceful yet ominous image of the tomb world below them. Are you suggesting that the enemy discovered this planet, even behind the no-field, and seeded it with a disease that killed everyone? Shiana nodded at the large screen. We must go down there and see for ourselves. Unwise, Duncan said. If a plague killed every single person. As Miles just pointed out, we Reverend Mothers can guard our bodies against the contamination. Garimi can go with me. This is foolhardy, Teg said. Being safe and careful has bought us little in the past 16 years, Garimi said. If we turn our backs on this opportunity to learn about the real enemy and the honored Matres, then we deserve our fate when they come back to haunt us. Garimi piloted the small lighter through the time-scoured atmosphere and over the ghostly metropolis. The empty city was ostentatious and impressive, composed primarily of tall towers and massive buildings with a superfluity of angles. Each structure had a thick solidity that expressed a certain loudness, as if the builders demanded grandeur and respect. But the buildings were crumbling. Showy extravagance, Shiana commented. It denotes lack of subtlety, perhaps even insecurity in their power. Inside her head, the ancient voice of Serena Butler awoke. In the time of Titans, the great Cymec tyrants built huge monuments to themselves. That was how they reinforced their own belief in their significance. Similar things had happened long before that, Shiana supposed. As humans, we learn the same lessons over and over and over again. We are doomed to repeat our mistakes. When she caught the Proctor Superior looking at her oddly, Shiana realized she had spoken aloud. This place has the undeniable mark of the honored Matres. Spectacular yet unnecessary lavishness, domination and intimidation. The whores bullied those they conquered, but in the end it wasn't enough. Even their incredible expenditure to generate a self-sustaining no-field proved inadequate against the enemy. Garimi's lips formed a hard smile. How it must have galled them to be forced into hiding, cowering behind invisibility and still failing. They set the lighter down in the middle of an empty street. Looking at each other for reassurance and resolve, Shiana and Garimi opened the airlock hatch and stepped out onto the graveyard world. They each took a cautious breath. Wispy gray clouds scudded across the skies like memories of industrial smoke. With their perfect immune system control, the sisters could guard every cell in their bodies and fend off any remaining vestiges of a plague. The honored Matres, however, had forgotten or never possessed such skills. The streets and landing pad were overgrown with tall grasses and hardy weeds that had cracked the armor pave. Wild shrubs grew into writhing shapes, composed mostly of thorns upon which a casually tossed victim could be impaled. Stunted trees resembled racks of swords and spearheads. At one time, Shiana supposed, the honored Matres must have considered these plants ornamental. Other knobby growths composed of interlocked lumps rose up like leprous fungi. The city was not silent, though. A gentle wind blew, moaning a somber song through broken windows and half-collapsed doorways. Flocks of long-feathered birds had taken up residence in the towers and on rooftops. Gardens, probably once tended by slaves, had grown into a wild riot of vegetation. Engorged trees had uprooted flagstones. Flowers poked from cracks in buildings like patches of brightly colored hair. A raw wilderness, bursting from its boundaries, had conquered the city. The planet had gleefully reclaimed itself, as if dancing on the graves of millions of honored Matres. Shiana walked forward, on guard. This empty metropolis had an ominous and mysterious feel, though she had satisfied herself that no one remained alive. She trusted her Bene Gesserit senses and reflexes to alert her to danger, but perhaps she should have brought along Herm or one of the other Futars as a guardian. The two women stood in somber contemplation, absorbing their surroundings. Shiana gestured to her companion. We have to find an information center, a library complex, or a data core. She studied the architecture around her. The skyline had a weathered and broken appearance. After a century or more without maintenance, some of the tall towers had collapsed. Poles that must once have held colorful banners were now naked. The fragile fabric had disintegrated with time. Use your eyes and what you've been taught, Shiana said. Even if the whores did originate from unschooled reverend mothers, maybe they were mixed with fish speaker refugees. Or maybe they have another origin entirely, but they carry some of our history in their subconscious. Garimi gave a skeptical snort. Reverend mothers would never have forgotten so many basic skills. We know from Mirbella that the whores have no access to other memory. Nothing in our history explains their sheer violence and unmitigated rage. Shiana remained unconvinced. If they came from the scattering, The Horrors have some commonality with human history, provided we go back far enough. In general, architecture is based on standard assumptions. A library or information center has a different look than an administrative complex or private dwelling. In a city such as this, there will be business buildings, receiving centers, and some sort of central information storehouse. The two walked past the stark thorn trees, studying the structures they saw. The buildings were blocky and fortress-like, as if the populace had feared that at any moment they would need to run inside and protect themselves from a violent external attack.
"This city must have been built before the planetary no-field was put in place," Garimi said.
"Note the siege mentality evident in these structures. But even the strongest weapons and battlements can't defend against a plague." By nightfall, after searching in dozens of dark buildings that smelled of animal dens, Shiana and Garimi discovered a record center that appeared to be less of a public library than a detention center. Here, surrounded by heavy shielding, some archives had remained intact. The pair dug into the background of this place, activating unusual but oddly familiar shigawire spools and engraved Redulian crystal sheets. Garimi returned to the lighter to transmit an update to the no-ship, informing the others of what they had found. By the time her companion came back, Shiana was sitting gravely beside a portable glow globe. She held up the crystal sheets.
"The plague that struck here is more virulent and terrible than any disease ever recorded. It spread with impossible efficiency and had virtually a 100% mortality rate."
"That's unheard of. No disease could possibly be so..."
"This one was. The proof is here."
Shiana shook her head.
"Even the horrific plagues from the Butlerian Jihad were not so efficient, and that epidemic spread everywhere and nearly brought an end to human civilization."
"But how did the honored Matres stop the disease once it took root here? Why didn't it infect everyone and kill them all?"
"Encapsulation and quarantine.
Utter ruthlessness. We know the Horrors operate in isolated cells. They fled from their heartland, always moving forward, never backward. There wasn't a cooperative trading network."
Garimi nodded coldly. "And their strict violence probably served them well. They would have allowed no mistakes."
Shiana selected a shigawire spool and played the recording. An image of a stern, honored Matre flashed orange eyes into the recorder. She appeared to be defiant, holding up her weak chin, baring her teeth. The woman seemed to be on trial, facing a stern tribunal and a growling audience. Female voices howling with anger strayed into the recording from the fringes.
"I am honored Matre Rika, an adept of the seventh level. I have assassinated 10 to reach my rank, and I demand your respect."
The outcries from the audience showed no respect at all.
"Why do you put me here on this stand? You know I am right."
"We're all dying," another shout came.
"It is your own fault," Rika snapped back. "We brought this fate on ourselves. We provoked the enemy of many faces."
"We are honored Matres. We are in control. We take what we wish. The stolen weapons will make us invincible."
"Really? Look what we reaped from it."
Rika held up her bare arms to show dark lesions covering her skin.
"Look well, for you will all experience it soon."
"Execute her," someone cried. "The long death." Rika bared her teeth in a feral grin.
"To what purpose? You know I will die soon anyway."
She showed the lesions on her arms again, So will all of you. Instead of responding to the question, an ancient female judge called for a vote, and Rika was indeed sentenced to the long death. Shiana could only imagine what that meant. Honored Matres were vile enough. What could they conceive of as the worst possible death?
Why didn't they believe her? Garimi said. If the plague was spreading before their eyes, the whores must have known Rika was right.
Shiana shook her head sadly. Honored Matres would never admit weakness or mortality. Better to lash out at a perceived enemy than to concede that they were all going to die anyway. I do not understand these women, the Proctor Superior said. I am glad we did not stay behind on Chapter House. We may never know where the whores originally came from, Shiana said, but I have no desire to live in their tomb. As far as she could tell, the plague seemed to have burned itself out, devouring every available victim and then leaving nothing else to infect.
I wish to leave this place as well.
Garimi suppressed a shudder, then seemed embarrassed by it. Even I would not consider this place as a new home for us. The remnants of death will stay in the atmosphere for centuries to come. Shiana agreed. Reinforcing their opinions, Teg reported from the no-ship that the satellites generating the planetary field of invisibility were failing. Within a few years, the cloak would fade away entirely. And, since the enemy had already found and destroyed this world, she and her followers would not be safe and invisible from the hunters here. Gathering the documentation they had found, Shiana and Garimi left the detention center and records vault and hurried back to the lighter in the gathering darkness. Information is always available if one is willing to go to extreme lengths to obtain it. The Mentat Handbook. The Honored Matres wanted everything, and Uxtal feared that the 8 new axolotl tanks in Bandalong would not be enough. Soon, as ordered by Helica and Navigator Edric, he would decant 8 golas of the Tliloxu Master Waf, the Mashik, the Master of Masters, who had been stored in Helica's Chamber of Horrors. 8 chances to recover the lost knowledge of Melange production. If that didn't work, he would make 8 more, and more again, a constant stream of possible reincarnations, all to obtain 1 set of memories, 1 key to knowledge that Uxtal could not figure out for himself. The Matre Superior had given the lost Tliloxu researcher everything he needed, and the navigators had paid her well for his efforts. But the problem was not so simple. After he removed the identical Waf copies from those wombs, Uxtal would have to bring them to maturity, and then break loose their memories and knowledge from past lives, like a man with a crowbar smashing open a sealed crate. But that was no easy process either. Even the 12-year-old Baron Harkonnen Gola had still not awakened. Thankfully, that was no longer his problem, since Krohn had decided to perform the task himself on Dan. Now, on his regular inspection walk among the pasty axolotl tanks, Uxtal felt satisfaction as he surveyed the rounded, fleshy bellies, the atrophied limbs, the faces so slack they looked like cauls of skin. Female bodies could be such useful things. Uxtal had already forced reckless speed upon the creation of the Tliloxu Master Golas. Aware of the constant slippage of time and the growing desperation of the Guild Navigators and Matre Superior Helica for spice, he decided speed was more important than perfection. He had used a forbidden, unstable acceleration process, derived from genetic traits associated with a formerly incurable aging disease. As a result, The 8 wafts would be born after only 5 months in the uterus, and once decanted, they would last 2 decades at most. They would grow quickly and painfully, and then they would burn out. Uxtal considered his solution quite innovative. He didn't care about these golas, or how many he might have to use up before he gained the necessary information. He only needed one to survive and to awaken. At any other time, he might have felt important, a vital asset, but neither the honored Matres nor the navigator seemed to respect him. Perhaps Uxtal should demand respect and insist on better treatment. He could refuse to do any more work. He could demand his due. "Stop daydreaming, little man," Ingva snapped. He nearly jumped out of his skin and looked quickly away. "Yes, Ingva. I am concentrating. Very delicate work." "She can't kill me. She knows it." "No mistakes," the sinewy crone warned. "No mistakes. Perfect work." He was far too frightened to make a mistake. He shuddered to think of the old WAF copies, brain dead and strapped to incline tables. Sperm factories. His own situation, while hellish, could have been far worse. Yes, it could have been worse. He tried to summon a hopeful smile, but could not find one within him. Ingva slithered up behind him and peered down at the axolotl tank that had once been an injured honored matre. "You breathe on them too much. Could contaminate them. Frighten the fetuses." "The tanks require close monitoring." Despite his struggles to contain his fear, his voice came out in a squeak. She pressed her shriveled body against him, attempting honored matre seductive techniques, though her body was like twisted wreckage. "It's such a waste that the matre superior has refused to bond you. If Helica does not want you, then it is time to make you my own toy."
She would not like that, Ingva. I promise you."
He felt nauseated.
"Helica will not be Matre Superior forever. Someone might assassinate her any day now. Meanwhile, I could make you work harder, little man. That would gain me great respect, increase my position of power, no matter what happens."
Fortunately, a commotion and a thick smell cut through the chemical odors in the axolotl labs, distracting Ingva. A dirty man clad in dirty clothes pushed a dirty cart along the sterile hall, his eyes cast down.
"Your delivery of slig meat," called the downtrodden farmer. "Freshly slaughtered, still bloody."
Ingva released Uxtal and stalked off toward the man, turning her ire on him.
"We expected you an hour ago. The slaves need time to prepare our feast for tonight."
No longer interested in Uxtal, Ingva went to tend to the meat. He shuddered, trying to keep the look of revulsion and relief from his face. The human mind is not a puzzle to be solved, but a treasure chest for us to open. If we cannot pick the lock, then we must smash it apart. Either way, the riches inside will be ours. Crone, communique to the face dancers. A cold rainstorm swept in over the oceans of Caladan. Waves crashed against rugged black rocks far below the restored castle. The local fishermen had brought in their boats and tied them to the docks, then huddled at home with their families. In the dim shadows of cultural memory, their Caladanian ancestors had loved their duke, but they did not hold the same reverence for the strangers who had rebuilt the ancient edifice and moved in. The castle's plaza windows were sealed against the storm's intensity. Dehumidifiers scoured the ever-present clamminess from the air. Thermal generators operated behind blazing holographic fires, warming the temperature to a comfortable level. Within a stone-walled chamber lit by fiery artificial light, Krohn laid out the instruments of torture and summoned the Baron Gola. Young Paolo was safe in his own quarters in another village, far from where anyone could find him. Today, though, was Baron Vladimir Harkonnen's day. The horrifically augmented emissaries from the outside masters stood against one of the stone walls, observing, recording. Their faces were pasty except for scarlet patches of raw flesh and unhealed wounds that held tubes and implants. The machinery made a distracting gurgle and hiss. The observers had been here, always observing Krohn and his pet project for years. Each day, he expected one of them to break down and fall apart, but the patchwork people remained unchanged, watching, waiting. He would show them a success today. Three face dancer assistants escorted the haughty young Gola. In the guise of guards, they chose to appear as muscular brutes who could snap a neck with two fingers. Young Vladimir's hair was mussed, as if he had been dragged out of a restless sleep. With a bored expression, he looked around the stone-walled chamber.
I'm hungry.
Better you don't eat. Less chance of vomiting, Krohn said. Then again, one additional